We're going to put a team out there that's going to go out there and play hard, execute our offense and defense and special teams, and that's what we're looking to do. I think everything's earned. You know, I'm not giving anybody anything. Whatever decision we make will be based on the feeling of how long we want guys to play. It won't be because of the weapon, because we have to learn how to practice against each other, take care of each other, and do things the right way. You know, this is a little bit different phase of training camp because now we're about to play an opponent. I'm really eager to see our whole football team, you know, against a different opponent. But obviously, watch our quarterback, you know, under duress, you know, when it's tough, when the other team is really coming after you. But also our offensive line, our defensive line, and our secondary, you know, and our linebackers. I'm going to be very into watching our football team play, and I'm probably going to have to catch myself because I have so many responsibilities as we go through this. But I am. I'm very excited about our guys going out and competing against somebody else for a change.
I can't tell you how valuable having an opportunity to work against a team, a very good football team, obviously. Yeah, well, some guys you don't have to see as much of, you know, and if you want to see a lot of the younger guys, because you know some of your older guys got a lot of good work, we'll look at that and kind of temper the number of reps that they had. So you may not see some of the older guys much, if at all, in some cases. In other cases, you'll see some of the young guys a little bit more. You know, I think he's delivering the ball better on time. I think he's gotten a little bit better feel for the concepts that we're using. I can see him kind of working through his progressions a lot more quickly, you know, just to see how we go and make adjustments with different personnel groupings, with heavy personnel or whatever it might be. But then also execution is key. You know, we want to see guys get in there and play well, and they'll be able to do their job correctly.
Solomon, LeBron James, laying in the weeds. Get out of his way.
LeBron again.
You know, anytime I got anything new, exclusive, I'm bringing it to y'all first. So, and I'm re-signing back with the Cleveland Cavaliers, man. My hometown team, I can't be more excited.
And in transition, James! Oh, with the hammer! James keeps his dribble somehow. Irving back to James! Oh, he throws it down!
This opportunity once again, defend our crown, you know, defend our title. We all know last year was a magical, inspiring, all the words you could come up with, man, it was an unbelievable season.
James fakes, James drives, James finishes, and the foul.
And I just can't wait to get the group back together, man. You know, the team, franchise, you know, lastly, you know what I'm saying? Let's get JR done. It's that time.
Welcome to the Bob Brantz Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And extravaganza, I had a hiccup in the middle of my first, or I guess that would be my third word of the program. And extravaganza, this was my second. Extravaganza, whatever it is, it's Friday, and it's right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. What's going on? Hope you're having a great day. We do have an extravaganza for you this afternoon. We're going to talk a little preseason NFL football in a bit. At about 3:35, we're going to go to Detroit and talk to Chris Lemieux, our good friend and sometimes co-worker here at The Ticket, by the way, who comes and produces for us, but also writes for theprideofdetroit.com, an SB Nation site, devoted to your Detroit Lions. A little preview of the Lions and the Steelers tonight in preseason game number one. Not that you can tell a whole lot of anything from anything you see tonight, but we will do it because that's the way the NFL has scheduled it. We get four of these things, sometimes five if you get in one of those in the Hall of Fame game or one of the extras. But we get four of these things, and we try to make the most of them as best we can. So we've got Chris Lemieux at 3:35 to talk about the Lions, and then we will also talk at 4:05. No, I beg your pardon, an hour later, at 4:35, we're going to talk with Dennis Mantiloff, who is out in Cleveland, and we will talk to him about the Browns and the Packers as we get set for preseason game number one for those clubs as well. So that's the interview portion of the program today. I'm looking forward to both of those conversations, but I am also looking forward to conversation with you right here, right now, at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. The question is on what? It's on whatever the heck you want it to be on, because this is an open lines edition of the program. We like to call it Free for All Friday right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. So any topic you want to get into is fair game. Now, I would be very, very hesitant under virtually any circumstances to start a show about soccer, primarily because I don't like soccer. And I don't like soccer, so I don't really talk about soccer. I don't want to trash soccer. Because there's no point in hurting other people's feelings who do like soccer. It's just not my game. I find it boring. I find it disinteresting. If that's another way of saying boring, I apologize for the redundancy, but it's not my game. I think there are a lot better things to do on a field than kick a ball and play keep away with it with your feet. So at any rate, I would not start other than the big breaking news story. And you just heard about it. Sweden has defeated and eliminated the United States in women's soccer. The U.S. women's national team is out. The defending U.S. women's soccer team, defending champion, I should say, is out of the Olympics, eliminated by Sweden in the most soccer of ways. And that is on penalty kicks. The U.S. has failed to reach the semis of a major tournament now for the first time in a long time. So Sweden 1-1 in regular play, is that what they call it? Ben, do you know anything about soccer?
You know, I don't, because like you, I really don't follow it at all.
Yeah, I mean, you're a guy. It's the way it ought to be. I'm sorry.
I like NASCAR. NASCAR's my sport.
You like NASCAR, really?
Oh, absolutely. Love it.
Oh, see, I got to tell you, I find NASCAR about as interesting as I do soccer. and again, that's not to bag on NASCAR fans either.
Right.
I mean, it's really not. It's just that some games are your games and some games are not. Listen, here's how stupid I am and how stupid the whole idea is, really. It's not just about me. But about how stupid it is. It's just such a matter of taste or preference. I would rather watch, although I couldn't name a professional bowler right now. I don't think I could anyway. No. I'm thinking of growing up when and you're too young to know this, but if you're growing up in the 70s and early 80s and, you know, you didn't have a whole lot, it was before the advent of ESPN, which I think started in what, 79 or something like that. But, the only sports, you know, you would have to watch, like on a Saturday afternoon, is ABC and Wide World of Sports. And you'd watch Wide World of Sports, and then you might watch Professional Bowlers Tour, the PBA, Professional Bowling Association. And I remember then, you know, Earl Anthony, and these are names that are just going to be right over your head. You, Ben, and probably everybody else listening. But, you know, Mark Roth was this big bear of a man, you know, who didn't have a whole lot of technique, but just like scared the pins over and just rolled as hard as he could and counted on pin action. And Marshall Holman, this bald dude with his perfect, I've already said too much. It's bowling. Okay. It's bowling. I find it boring today, but I watched it growing up because you only had, you know, three channels pretty much. You had your ABC network affiliate, your NBC and your CBS. And occasionally you might have, a UHF, station. And so you didn't have a ton of sports, and bowling was something that was one of them. So it was on, and you watch it a little bit, and, you know, especially if you have a close match, and it's 247 to 239 going into the final frame, and it could have its little drama, right? Even today, you know, 30 years after all of that, if NASCAR was all that was on one station, soccer was on the other, you know, I'm going back into, like, the, you know, days of three channels to choose from thing, and bowling was on the third, I'd watch the third. I'd watch the bowlers. I think I'd probably watch the bowlers. I don't know if I would ever watch the fishermen. Do you ever watch fishing on live TV or on TV shows? They have fishing competitions. Dudes actually racing out to areas and sitting in their boats and baiting their hooks and talking about what they've got and all this stuff. And actually, there's fishing competitions. I don't know. That's a close call between that and maybe a soccer match. It's really hard. I guess I would probably turn it off and go, you know, like, I don't know, mow the lawn with a pair of scissors, because it would be more entertaining to me to lay there in the grass cutting than it would be watching any of those things, I think. But I would watch bowling. Anywho, I don't know anything about soccer, and Ben doesn't know anything about it. By the way, Jim Cushlin is not here. Jim Cushlin is off on assignment, as a matter of fact, so he's not here right now. Now stop that.
Oh, there we go.
Stop. It's not like he can't hear you. He's monitoring the show. He's listening out at Yark, and he's going to talk to us in about 15 minutes as he's selling cars today and making comments right here on the Extravaganza. We'll get him on the phone sooner or later, but he's not here at the moment, is all we're saying. Jesus. Wow. You can't say it without, you can't keep this audience under control. Ben, can you please? Ah, my goodness. Studio audiences. Sometimes you just can't control them. So Ben doesn't know anything about soccer.
Nope.
Cushlin, I'm hoping, doesn't know anything about soccer. He would tell us, well, I mean, you know, then again, I don't know. There's a chance he might actually know something about soccer, and that frightens me just a little bit. Maybe that's why people are, you know, so happy when he's not around. So. Oh, my. Yeah, I guess. So they were tied at 1-1 in is it called regulation time? Or is it called regular time? Something like that? It's like regular time. So it's 1-1 after 90 minutes of play. And then so they decide they haven't settled it in regular time, so we're going to go to a field goal competition. What? Yeah, well, they call it penalty kicks, but in football, and I mean real football, as in Americanized football, it would be like having a field goal competition. We're going to set up our kicker from 45 yards and your kicker from 45 yards, and we're going to take turns to see who can bang them through. And whoever misses first, the other team wins. That's essentially what it is. They called it penalty kicks. And on penalty kicks, the U.S. women's national team was defeated by Sweden today by a final score of 1-1. That's the final score of the match, is 1-1. But I guess then in soccer parlance, what, they put it in parentheses after 1-1 where it says 3-4 or 4-3? Is that how that works? I'm guessing. I'm looking at the score right now, and it says final. U.S. 1, Sweden 1. And then something in parentheses, it says 3-4. Okay, so those must have been the penalty kicks. Three penalty kicks went in for the U.S. team. Four went in for the Swedish team. And that's it. So that's how we're going to go ahead and settle an Olympic competition. The U.S. women's national team is out in the quarterfinals on penalty kicks. How do you feel about that? I can't wait for the next NBA Finals game that's tied at the end of regulation. Cavaliers 106, Warriors 106, and now we go to penalty shots. At the line for the Warriors, it'll be Steph Curry. For the Cavaliers, it'll be Kyrie Irving. They will shoot until somebody misses. Really? Is that how we're gonna end this? Really? Penalty shots? That's what they do in soccer. And I know they do it in hockey too, in some place, in some formats. But I don't like it. Play the game until there's a winner. As far as I'm concerned, play the game until there's a winner. I'll be honest with you. I don't like the way they do it in the NFL either. And that is playing the game until somebody scores. Oh, but we have a little caveat there too. If the team who receives the kick scores, the other team, or especially if it's only a field goal, right? Isn't that the new rule? If they score a field goal, the team that kicked off gets to receive the ball as well, and then they can try to score a field goal, and then we play until somebody else scores, or until if that first team gets a touchdown. Or no, in fact, I think the first team has to, if they score a touchdown, it's over, right? Yeah, that's what it is. The team that receives the kick in the NFL, they just started this last year, if I'm not mistaken. The team that receives the kick, if they score a touchdown, the game is over. If they score only a field goal, then the other team possesses the ball. Do I have that right? I just get so overwhelmed by these rules changes, especially when they're so stupid. And you know, college football, high school football isn't much better. You get the ball at the 25, and you get to take it in. And then give the other team the ball at the 25, and they get to take it in. We're completely discounting special teams of punting and punt returning. We're discounting kickoffs and kick returning. We're just playing offense and defense. And, yes, special teams in terms of field goals, but that's all. I don't like it. Play the game until there's a winner. Put 5 minutes on the clock and play it. The NBA does it. Major League Baseball plays until there's a winner. Not until the first score, but until the first inning is completed in which somebody scores and takes the lead. You know, so the home team still gets its bottom ups. I don't like it. I'm looking at some of the comments here. I'm reading some of the comments on the ESPN page of ESPN FC. And what is ESPN FC? I'm learning new stuff as I go on live radio. The headline, Sweden wins on penalty kicks, U.S. women's national team eliminated, leads to a page when I click it on it for the game, and it's ESPN FC. And I guess that's something to do with
soccer. Soccer, yeah.
Yeah, but what's FC?
I don't know.
It's not even FB like for football, you know, the European word for soccer. It's FC, but whatever. Football channel? I don't know. I don't really care that much, I suppose. Anyway, some of the comments under the game. Penalty kicks have been about equally profitable and heartbreak-riddled for my rooting interests, but I'm really not a fan of it to decide games. It rewards teams that just park the bus for entire games. Credit to Sweden for making it work, but it's boring to watch. I'm sorry. Amen. That's what I'm talking about. And this is somebody who's a soccer fan. He doesn't even like it. Let's see, what else? Tough loss. That doesn't matter. That's actually about the teams and about the game, and I don't really care. Aside from being robbed on the offside call, that's really something I don't care about either. Okay, I'm done with the soccer commentary. It just literally happened as we were coming on the air that the U.S. national team lost and the announcement was made. I wasn't watching it, obviously, so it wasn't that interesting to me. But the U.S. women's national team is out, and they lost it on penalty kicks. So we got that going for us, which is nice. Some of the news in the montage today that you just heard, LeBron James is now the richest player per season in NBA history. He broke the record when he signed a 3-year, $100 million contract yesterday. A lot of people are saying it's good. A lot of people are saying it's exactly how it ought to be. And to an extent, they're right. The best players ought to make the most money. This certainly makes things a lot more palatable than when Mike Conley had the richest contract in the history of the National Basketball Association. The best player should have it, but $33 million a year, $33.3 million a year, does that make a whole lot of sense? It depends on your point of view. If you have the point of view that these guys are already making more than perhaps they should given what they are being asked to do, especially compared to some of the other sports, okay, there's an argument and a sports radio discussion to be had there. But if you're making the argument that these guys are still underpaid, particularly when you're talking about a guy like LeBron James, whose presence impacts a local economy, like the economy out in Cleveland, Ohio, literally to the tune of maybe $1 billion a year in restaurants and hotels and in shops and so many other things. Jobs are created because a basketball team does as well as a basketball team has done since, for example, LeBron James went back to Cleveland. It impacts the community by maybe $1 billion a year when you add it all up. Does that mean he deserves $1 billion a year? I guess that just depends on who you ask. And if you listen to ESPN today on television, one guy said that's exactly what it does mean. He should get $1 billion. Come on, Max. Speak up.
LeBron James just had basically like $900 million.
You can say it. Dollars. Come on, Max. All right, we're having a tech glitch here. My apologies. We'll try to get that worked out. Max Kellerman on ESPN this morning talking to Stephen A. Smith, saying that LeBron James basically signed a $100 million contract that was about $900 million light. We'll see if we have this working.
Dollars stolen from him. People are going to focus on the $100 million he just got. What about the...
Once again, my apologies for the technical glitch. I thought we had it all loaded up. Okay. But he's basically saying what I was saying, that, you know, he's worth $1 billion a year to the local economy, so therefore he should get more than that. His argument, and I found it interesting, even though I disagreed with it, his argument is that the existence of a salary cap in the NBA and a max contract amount is just, you know, theft. It's robbing the players of being able to negotiate what their true value is worth in the name of competitive balance. His argument was that, you know, that it's not about competitive balance at all. That the real story here is that the owners instituted these artificial salary caps and max contracts simply to save more money for themselves. Because if they actually have to pay somebody like LeBron what he's worth, and if LeBron was a free agent in the true meaning of the word free agent, if he was free to negotiate his best price anywhere he wanted, somebody in the NBA would pay him $1 billion a year, or $750 million, or something of that nature. Maybe not a year, but a 3-year deal worth $750 instead of $100, or, you know, $1 billion instead of $100 million. Somebody might do that. And he says it's just the owners trying to save money is why. I 100% disagree with Kellerman on that issue. And here's why. It is about competitive balance. Because if that's all it took, then you would have what you have in Major League Baseball. The richest team with the richest owners in the biggest market making the biggest money on local television and or radio contracts, who have bigger fan bases to draw from to get bigger gates at the ballpark, or in this case, in an NBA arena, they would just be able to build a super team like we're talking about, like kind of what they're doing out there in Oakland. But it's harder at Golden State because you do have a salary cap. That's the only thing that would stop some multi-billionaire. Let's say Bill Gates or somebody like that, or how about Mark Zuckerberg, the owner of Facebook, who's literally worth, you know, tens of billions of dollars, bought a franchise, and there was no cap and no max contract. He could offer $1 billion to LeBron, you know, maybe $900 million to Steph Curry, maybe $900 million to Kevin Durant. You know, and on we go until you have, look at this, a team that would go 82-0 and that would make a mockery of the sport. They have to do this. His argument is that this is, you know, in violation of what true free agency is, that it limits the players. It takes away their opportunity to actually earn as much money as they can, which is what free agency is supposed to be about. I just fundamentally disagree. LeBron James got an enormous deal. It's good for basketball that he got more money than a guy like Michael Conley, who had the previously richest deal. And it's good for the Cleveland Cavaliers, too, that he is now locked up for 3 years, or at least the next two. The third year is a player option. So he could still technically go back into the market again and look for the next biggest deal and if the salary cap goes up. And again, the entertaining the idea or the possibility of playing somewhere else, all of that stuff would be back on the table. But at least for the next 2 years, we know. He's got a three-year, $100 million extension, with a third year being the option for the player. And what can he complain about? The other part about that, too, which is obvious, with LeBron signing the deal, is, you know, he doesn't need the $100 million. I mean, if he played for 3 years for $1 million, it wouldn't really affect him, because he'll never be able to see that physical money anyway. It'll always be just at the end of a ledger, at the bottom of a ledger, that his accountant keeps showing him what his true net worth is. And it'll always be more money than he can ever spend, always be more money than his kids can ever spend, always be more money than his kids' kids could ever spend 100 years from now. Because his basketball salary is a pittance compared to his Nike salary. His Nike salary is about a $1 billion contract by itself. So LeBron James is never going to be hurting. Nobody needs to worry about, you know, these players not getting their fair share. LeBron James just got robbed of $900 million because his true value is so much higher than that. I don't think anybody really has to worry about
LeBron
that.
LeBron James just had basically like $900 million stolen from him. People are going to focus on the $100 million he just got. What about the $900 million extra that he's worth that he's not going to get paid? And how does this affect things? In other words, when you have a league with a cap and a max contract, all that ever is, kids, don't buy that this is about competitive balance. It's nonsense. It's about funneling money from the players to the owners. And how does this affect things negatively? Let's take LeBron James, and you mentioned a name I want to focus on for a second, Stephen A. Mike Conley. Mike Conley is an excellent point guard. When you think about constructing a championship team, he's like one of the guys, you're like, boy, if he's your point guard, you're on your way. He plays it just the way you want a point guard to play the position, you know, minus the kind of obvious talent of a Westbrook or something like that. But the fact that Mike Conley makes in the neighborhood per year of what LeBron James makes means that the system is broken. It's not like any talent evaluator or GM. Stephen A., you bring up the point about the revenue he generates. So there's two things. There's the on-the-floor value, on-the-court value, and there's the off-the-court money value. No evaluator in either realm would ever think Mike Conley is nearly as valuable as LeBron James, yet he's going to be paid that way. And so what you have is a warping of the dollar in the NBA to the talent on the floor. And this is why you get these kind of weird rosters and cap problems, etc., because they're not letting the marketplace dictate what guys are getting paid.
All right, so that's the view of Max Kellerman, who's on ESPN in the morning. Obviously, Mike and Mike, of course, is what I like to listen to in the morning. You have it right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. I sometimes flip on the First Take show that comes on after that. And it's good for discussion. It really is. And particularly in this particular case. And I really will say this. I am not a big fan of what I've heard from Max Kellerman a lot on that program. A lot of things I have completely disagreed with him on. In this one, however, he is half right. Half right in that it isn't right that Mike Conley, a good point guard, but not a great one. I think he completely overstated, by the way, Mike Conley's value to a team that is trying to win a championship. I don't see him as being one of those. It's not like there's Curry, Irving, Westbrook, and Conley. No, he doesn't belong in that conversation as a point guard. But what I do like that he said is it is insane that he is anywhere near LeBron James in average dollars per year. Because he's in a totally different league than LeBron James, a lower one in terms of real worth and ability. LeBron James belongs in the top stratosphere, along with maybe just a handful of other players, like a Curry or like a Durant or like a Westbrook possibly. And it really is a very short, short list when you really talk about the best of the best of the best. So he belongs in that stratosphere. And Conley should be nowhere near him. But because of the existence, and this is where I say Kellerman is right, because of the existence of a cap, the salary cap and the max contract cap, well, all you got to do is say, I'm maxing you out, and somebody says, I'm maxing you out, and the max contracts are going to be very similar. And they shouldn't be. So from that standpoint, he's right. But where he's wrong is saying that a guy should be paid for his economic impact or his economic value. Because if that's the case, then the person who invented or created the iPhone, or the person who invented one of the most powerful and most used apps of all time, the person who created the GPS, the impact on economies with those things is astronomical. But that person is going to be paid whatever a software engineer's salary is, not going to be paid the billions of dollars or multiple billions of dollars worth of economic impact they may have had on, you know, the greater, the American marketplace. You still have to recognize you're doing a job. Just because you do it exceptionally well, it means we're going to pay you exceptionally well, but we're not going to pay you dollar for dollar what your worth is to your community. I understand the value point. Like I said, if you are generating tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, you deserve to make more than anybody else who doesn't generate that. But it doesn't mean you deserve the hundreds of millions of dollars yourself. Your job is still not as important, no matter how well you dunk, no matter how good of a three-point shooter you are, how many chase-down blocks you have, how many steals you have. None of those things are as important as the brain surgeon who saves a life. None of them are as important as, the heart surgeon. None of them are as important as so many different positions that you think about, that are worth far more than they get paid. It's just that this is what you do. We're going to reward you exceptionally well, compensate you exceptionally well for what you do, and we're going to thank you for the huge economic impact you may have, but we're not going to pay you dollar for dollar for that impact. That's where I will disagree with Kellerman. All right, it's 3:32. We didn't even get to Alex Rodriguez yet, who plays his final game as a New York Yankee and maybe in Major League Baseball, maybe. Because I don't know if I trust him to actually retire after this game. He's probably going to try to catch on with somebody for next spring in another uniform. But A-Rod, we're going to talk about that too, and where he would go down in the history of history if the word steroids had never been invented. If no one had ever heard of steroids before, and Alex Rodriguez just did what he did, and we didn't know that steroids were a thing. Where would he go down in the pantheon of greatest baseball players of all time? Want to get into that a little bit. But coming up next, we are going to shift gears to the National Football League because it is back. Even though it's only in the scrimmage action, it is at least action. Preseason football tonight, the Lions, the Steelers, the Browns, the Packers. We are going to talk about it with Chris Lemieux starting off as he brings us a Lions preview. From the website and the pages of, if indeed it were a book, of PrideOfDetroit.com. Chris Lemieux joins us to talk Lions football right after this on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
All right, it is 3:40, and that means it's time, as promised, even though we're only a couple of minutes late. Let's get to him. Chris Lemieux joins us once again. Chris writes for PrideOfDetroit.com. He is also a part-time, sometime colleague of ours right here working at ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, and it's always great to talk Lions football with him. Chris, what's going on, brother? How you feeling?
Not much going on today. Just kind of, I guess, for many people, football is back. I'm going to annoy my managing editor if he's listening by talking about CFL and arena football. But, hey, you know, for some people, there's different thresholds for football. For me, I just love watching this game. But, you know, we actually get to talk Lions for once, so that's good. That's good.
So what are you saying, that this isn't, like, really football back just because it's preseason? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, it's varying degrees for everyone. I've kind of had this complaint for a while that I think, like, some football fans out there risk turning into what I've always seen as a caricature of baseball fans who are like, all right, pitchers and catchers report. All right, spring training begins. They have like eight different beginnings to the baseball season.
Right.
And I just don't want to be that kind of person for the NFL. So it's interesting it's hard, right? Because I saw a lot of Bears fans freaking out last night because the Bears got shut out and they just looked awful in the first preseason game. But it's preseason. It's an extension of training camp. It's the games don't matter, and it's just a matter of seeing who looks good coming back, and maybe there's some guys in the depth chart really looking to get their spot in, but the end results are still, you know, it's a scrimmage game.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, they've been doing scrimmaging co-practices, if you will, with the Steelers last week anyway, right? So, I mean, it's really kind of an extension of that.
Yeah, it's kind of like I went up with my friends to Detroit. They did the Lions themselves at Ford Field. They did a simulated mock game. A lot of people came in. There was a bunch of kids up there, too. We all had fun. Eric Ebron, unfortunately, went down, kind of eclipsed most of that day. But it's kind of the same thing, except it's with the Steelers. And I wouldn't really mind it so much if it wasn't for the fact that the NFL is trying to charge people, like, full price to go to these games.
Oh, yeah, and that's always been an issue. Each and every August we talk about this, and it gets more painful every year because of the way they do this. It is just so unnecessary. It doesn't help them, the owners I'm talking about, when you sell all of those season tickets and people have to pay full price as part of their season ticket package. But then you only get, 20 or 25,000 people in a 60 or 70,000 seat stadium because people don't want to go the backups and the third stringers and the fourth stringers.
Sure.
And then, of course, they lose revenue on, parking and concessions and everything else they could get if they just charged a fair price for, whatever you want to call it. If you want to call it an extension of the training camp, or if you want to call it a glorified scrimmage, it's essentially what it is.
Sure, and I found it very emblematic and, kind of symbolic this year that we have the Hall of Fame game canceled because people were rushing to get that field painted up. And I have a friend at Texas A&M. He could probably explain to me what happened there more than anything, but I guess they must have mistaken grass, thought it was like grass and started to treat it like it was grass by heating it up, and it's not. It's turf, and that's rubber, and it melted or something. I'm not quite sure all of what happened there.
Who does that? You know what? I mean, you're getting me off on a tangent here, but it's okay. You did it, so here we go. I'm trying to figure this out. I was is the rubberized turf there in Canton any different than the rubberized turf on any other playing surface that is in operation in America today? From high school surfaces who have that same, high school stadiums that have that same surface, to college programs, to the NFL. Is there any difference in that turf there than there is anywhere else?
No, it's AstroTurf. It's
rubber. It's recycled tires.
Yeah. I don't know how someone made this mistake. I can only assume that they didn't have their usual grounds crew in. I'm not privy to a bunch of the details. Again, it's just, but you're seeing less natural grass fields even up in Canton,
Ohio.
Well,
yeah, because this acts as natural
grass.
This doesn't act as AstroTurf used to, of course, which was just a carpet. It acts as grass. It's thick like grass. It's cushiony like grass.
But the base is still rubber.
But the base is rubber. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. My point to that was, if I can't imagine there's just like, hey, we have to paint the field. Somebody going up to Home Depot and get some paint. If you're doing one of these fields, especially with the NFL in control, I gotta believe there's one place you get the paint from. There's one technique for applying it. There's one technique for prepping a game. How on earth do they not follow the standard protocol that you follow every time there is a game played, where they change the logos and they add special things, and it's Veterans Day weekend this week, so we're gonna honor the vets and we're gonna have camouflage end zones and veterans logos at the 30-yard line facing each direction. All this crap they've been doing forever. How do you just not know how to do it for a game like that? It was insane.
Yeah, I don't know. I can only guess someone was trying to be clever by half, as one of my friends would always say, clever by half. But I can tell you this, they probably won't mess it up at Heinz Field.
Yeah, no, I would imagine they would not be there for that.
No,
so anyway,
not for Heinz.
So
yeah.
to the point about the game, obviously it doesn't matter, and the score doesn't matter, but there is value to them in that. Coaches, because for fans, we're always like, let's cut the preseason in half, cut it from 4 to 2, and then let's just get on with it. And I'm in that camp. But for the coaches, there is value. While they don't want the regulars getting hurt, they do want opportunities to see their young guys or their free agent signees or the guys they brought in who are trying to hang on for 1 or 2 more years, see if they got anything left in the tank, guys coming off injuries. They do want as many opportunities as possible before they make final roster decisions.
Absolutely.
And that's
especially
why this game does have value.
They are.
What's that,
yeah,
Chris?
Especially especially as small as these rosters are, like, you consider it, and you consider also that there's no NFL Europe anymore. There's no minor league to store these guys away. So I think the preseason at 4 games is here to stay until they can figure out where to store guys, because, was it 53 by the time it's all cut down, said and done? That's impressively low. And, you need the time to see guys. Like, I mean, we'll talk about him in a little bit. I was really impressed over training camp with Lions wide receiver, undrafted free agent, Jay Lee. And, yeah, I'd like to see him get enough opportunity to show that he can make contributions to this team.
Yeah, and that's what this is all about. And I agree. It is really a low roster. You know, it's the biggest roster of any of the major sports, obviously. And so you say, well, what's so small about it? But you have 22 starting positions on every team, plus kicker and punter and long snapper. So
right.
you know, if you even just go too deep, you're up to 44 plus those, you know, those three guys. So you're up to 45. You only have eight other positions to mess around with to decide where are we going to be three deep or where are we going to go four and five deep, for example, at wide receiver, five and six deep, and only stick with one guy at another position or two guys at another position. It is very hard to do, and that's why coaches really need as much evaluation time as they can get, including
right.
games that the rest of us yawn through for the most part after the first quarter in a game like tonight.
Yeah, I'm not even interested in seeing the starters. Like, again, you're trying to get down from 90 men on this roster to, I think, 75 after preseason game three. And then, again, more cuts. You're almost cutting off close to about, not fully 50%, but around there, really, just to make these cuts. And, like, yeah, like, you see that. Like, the Lions only ran two quarterbacks last year on their roster, which is kind of unusual for me traditionally. But, like, yeah, no, I can understand it when you only have 53 people on the roster.
Chris, let's play with your article that you wrote today for the website for PrideOfDetroit.com. Panic, grading the potential fear factors from the Lions-Steelers preseason game. And I'll just run through a few of these, and you go ahead and tell us. I'll read the fear factor, and you tell us what your grade is on it. First, the Lions getting shut out. You're obviously messing around with the Chicago fans.
They got shut out. Like, I think the problem for the Bears fans is that it's not they got shut out, but it was just the state of the team and how they got shut out. We were kind of watching it on and off that game and a couple other preseason games, and just their entire offense just looked really bad. Like, that offensive line looked bad. I feel bad for the Bears because it's like this is going to generate a lot of pressure on them, and it's not a team I really had high hopes for to begin with. But in general, a shutout shouldn't be that bad, but it's always the factors about how they get shut out. But from what I understand, we're going to even see less of the first team offense than we normally would because, for one, the Steelers are sitting a few of their starters. Ben Roethlisberger's not playing. Antonio Brown's not playing. Le'Veon Bell's not playing. And from what I'm reading, it just finished pouring, like, buckets in Pittsburgh.
Right.
So they should probably even sit Matt Stafford just on the fear of just getting him injured playing on a slick surface.
Yeah, that's probably not a bad thought. You don't want to mess around with something like that. And
yeah.
You're right.
Hello?
You're right for a team to be, the zero on the board that Chicago had yesterday isn't the issue. It's how they look doing it that is the issue. And that's not something
hello?
You want to deal with. Are you still there, Chris? Chris is yelling hello like he can't hear us.
Hello?
Ben,
yeah,
grab Chris, please, and reestablish that connection.
Chris appears to be still here. It's very odd.
Well, he's not, so
right.
he's yelling hello. So fix that for us, please. All right, so we'll try to reconnect with Chris Lemieux. For some reason, he can't hear us anymore, so we'll continue on this. As a matter of fact, while we reestablish that connection, I'll go back to Chris's article, which is just kind of fun. These are the fear factor grades, grading the potential fear factor from the games tonight. The Lions getting shut out gets a D on the panic scale because it doesn't really matter if they get shut out. It's just a matter of are you seeing what you want to see from various positions on the offensive side of the ball. On the other hand, he has the Lions getting picked apart over the middle yet again. That's a grade B panic. That is a real concern. Not having DeAndre Levy yet again is a decent excuse, but he said it's got to get better than this, even as early as tonight. Number three, the Lions lose the preseason game. Fear factor? F. Who gives a crap is essentially what Chris's point is. Could not agree more. One of the first teams, offense or defense, looks sloppy, disjointed, and discombobulated. That one he gives a C. It's just the first preseason game, yes, but it's putting the spotlight on what should be worrisome for days to come, and that's very true. Jay Lee does not play well. That's a D is what we got from Chris, and we'll talk to him as soon as
we got him back.
We got him back?
Yep.
I'm sorry about that. Not sure what happened there.
Yeah, I couldn't figure it out either. I could hear you yelling hello over and over and over again. And
I had no sound. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't want to get up the airwaves, so
yeah, no,
go on. I'm sorry.
Good. That's all good. It's all good. I was just running through the rest of, but some of your fear factor grades here.
Yeah, some of these are humorous.
And they are.
To be sure.
Well, obviously, like the first one, for example. But some of them are serious. Like, you know, your second one where you talked about getting picked apart over the middle again, obviously a concern for the defense, and you'd like to see some improvements being made there even as early as the first game.
Yeah, and I mean, it's going to be hard with DeAndre Levy, but like, if your entire plan is hope DeAndre Levy is healthy, that's really not much of a plan here. This linebacking core was probably part of, along with the offensive line, the weakest unit last year for the Lions. Like, you need guys like Tyron Walker, who they just gave a bunch of money to really step up, and there's a bunch of guys, they have a linebacker they haven't even, like, Kyle Van Noy's been on this team for years, and no one's seen hide or hair of him. You want to start seeing something else from your other linebackers.
The running game is a concern as well, and one of the fear factors you write as far as tonight's game, game one of the preseason, Zach Zenner nor Stephen Ridley, neither one of them show considerable promise, and you gave that a C-. Why?
Well, because Amir Abdullah is still injured, so I'm not going to worry too much about the running game, but you know, we've been having these discussions internally about the idea of running back by committee. Amir Abdullah is still, you know, this is his sophomore year, didn't really, like, showed some promise early on last year, but then, like, just vanished. And then you have Theo Riddick, who's really good, but he's not, he doesn't take much out of the backfield. He's receiving running back, so you don't want to be too predictable in that regard if you have Theo Riddick out there. So you kind of need a third running back in this running back by committee, so... And unfortunately,
can Riddick carry the ball? I mean, is he only going to be good for catching the ball out of the backfield? You don't think Jim Bob is going to try to get him more carries?
I think his like career high carry has been something like 4.5 yards or something close to that.
But does that mean he can't do that, or that's just not what he has been asked to do? Because I kind of feel like you said, you can't be predictable. And if Riddick's in the game, you know they're throwing the football. Mm-hmm. Or he's just a decoy. You would have to think that he can handle it a little bit. You know, especially if it is, as you point out, a running back by committee approach.
Sure. And to be clear, Amir Abdullah can actually catch the ball pretty well himself too. So if he's dimensions
a dual threat,
there,
right?
Yeah. So it's just a matter of just having that power back, someone who replaces what Joik Bell brought to the team, someone who can kind of just punch it up the middle. And I don't know if Riddick's kind of that guy just systematically, but yeah, I haven't watched too much of Riddick running, to be honest.
Let's talk about the offensive line. The offensive line fails to stop anything more than a wet tissue could. You gave that a B fear factor. So if that is what it looks like tonight, that's a legit concern.
We were arguing about this. Like, you know, you see a lot of talk about Riley Reiff being the really good guy right now at right tackle, but like, I'm just looking at the depth chart right now. Like, there's been fears about Laken Tomlinson for a while. What to do even at left guard? We're not sure what to do with Jeff Schwartz or Joe Dahl. We're pretty sure Cornelius Lucas is going to get cut, but, like, this was the big factor last year. Like, of course, you're going to the system with offensive coordinator Jim Bob Cooter, who's prioritizing faster releases out of Matthew Stafford, no longer just holding that ball a long time with the Lombardi offense. But, like, if you don't have the offensive line in this league, you're not going to do anything.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Obviously, you know, and with Matthew Stafford, well, you went on to him there. His performance can largely be dictated, if he even plays at all tonight. It'll probably be just a series. That's just the way these things go. Do you care at all how he looks other than if he is on his back three times, you know, in the first series?
No, because it's preseason game one. Like, okay. He even looked kind of bad during the mock game, but, like, we don't worry too much about it. And there's nothing really you can do. Like, Stafford's your guy no matter what. It's not like there's a backup here. Few teams have these backups to really turn to if they already have an established guy. Like, what are you going to do if Stafford's bad? Turn to Dan Orlovsky? Like, he's who he is, and you're going to have to ride or die with him through the season.
What about Rudock? What do you expect to see from Rudock? He'll probably get quite a bit of time, right?
Probably with third team. We watched him during that simulated game on Saturday at Ford Field, and the only balls I saw him throwing were either at the ground or towards fans. Like, I found it very telling that every interview about him has said, like, oh, Rudock is, like, of people talking about him, is that Rudock's smart. And when I translate that out of just, you know, PR gibberish speak from players and coaches, it means that Rudock can read defenses. And he probably knows where to put the ball, but he physically just doesn't have the arm to do it.
But he did not look like his arm was that weak at Michigan last year. I mean, not that he was, you know, a rifleman, but I mean, he looked like he had a strong enough arm, and I think that's the reason why he was taken. And you know what I'm wondering too is are we finding out that once he's away from Jim Harbaugh, maybe that's where he found his success last year is working with and being coached by Jim Harbaugh, and now that he's kind of left to his own devices, he maybe is not as good as he played at Michigan.
Yeah, I mean, I've been complaining about this to a few people. The NFL's pretty bad at development, all said and done. Once you get into the NFL, you're not going to be really developing that much. And again, kind of goes back to my talk about just when it comes to, well, you can improve, but you can't, like, there's no one really on a roster, the coaching roster, that's really, like, development's mainly their concern. It's always kind of been my fear of listening to these guys talk about how unready quarterbacks are coming out of college these days, is that they just don't want to really coach these guys up into a pro system. And Rudock is, like, I don't know. I mean, I watched some of him at Michigan, but it was a lot of just, I mean, defense is just so much slower in college. It's so much faster out here. Like, you could see just how he struggled with a few of these routes. So right. We'll just have to see. Like, this is the first time we're going to see him in action. It'll be against probably the third-string Steelers defense, too. But we should see. But I don't, like, I just, Orlovsky just looks so much more polished because he's been doing this for years.
Yeah, exactly.
He's
a veteran at it, and he understands his role, and he understands how to make the most of his opportunities. I don't think there's any question.
I just think Rudock's going to the practice squad at this rate. It's probably his where he's going to go for now.
Yeah, and that might be it. Finally, last one, as we talk about your fear factors of game one of the preseason tonight, the Lions and the Steelers. Bane detonates the series of bombs he's planted beneath Heinz Field, plunging both teams deep into the earth, beginning his reign of terror over the city of Pittsburgh. Grade B, please explain.
That's just there to be funny. I gave Matt Stafford like an S rating for if he gets injured. Just like if that's it, mission's failed, but Bane, yeah, we can probably dig him out. I don't know.
I think that's a little higher than a B, I got to think, because, you know, I mean, it's not just the bombs, obviously, and Heinz Ward nearly getting swallowed up, but, I mean, it's, like you said, it's the beginning of the reign of terror, because then the nuke, of course, is going to have to be dealt with. So, I mean, I'm a little impressed that you're staying as calm and as chill as you are by just staying with a B here.
I mean, I'm looking at our current state of politics. It would totally be not surprising to me, to be honest, if that kind of thing happened. Like, yeah,
November
like that,
8th,
that's about par for the course.
November 8th might be Bane detonating a series bomb.
It might be. I just saw Suicide Squad, too, so I still have Batman on my mind.
Did it suck as bad as I heard it sucked?
Oh, I actually wrote a review for it, comparing a bunch of parts to the Detroit Lions as my way to get a review into Pride of Detroit. It was very, very disjointed. Like, on a base level, I had fun. And on a base level, I'm not as insulted watching Suicide Squad as I am watching the same Marvel movies for 8 years.
Right.
But, like, it was very disjointed. Warner Brothers really screwed with this movie. They tried to reshoot a bunch of it, and you could tell. Like, you could really... Will Smith...
Did it feel like Tim Burton got his hands on it, that kind of a thing?
Tim Burton could have probably done a better job with this, to be honest.
I don't believe
actually.
That. Tim Burton's horrible. Tim Burton's
really?
Horrible.
Really? We were just talking about his 89 Batman the other night. We love it.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Wait.
Are you talking about the original Batman?
Yeah, Batman and Batman Returns. Yeah.
See, now Batman Returns, that was the one with the Penguin, right?
Yes.
That was
Danny
awful.
DeVito. What?
That was awful. The first one with the Joker was fine because Nicholson saved it. Michael Keaton was a terrible Batman choice. Horrible, horrible, horrible. Don't buy him for a second as being the multimillionaire by day and the Dark Knight at night. He was a terrible choice, but Nicholson saved it. The second one with Danny DeVito and the Penguin was just absolutely inexcusable. Almost worse than Bat Nipplegate. I mean, come on.
You know what? It was a different take on the Batman thing that Burton did. Like, I think my friend Ryan pointed out that, like, Burton admittedly had only read like one Batman comic before he began, and he went on this really psychological tear trying to convince us that, like, Michael Keaton's Batman had like a split personality disorder, which ironically inspired.
I mean, everything he does goes on a terror and tries to just. I mean, honest to God, the guy's just never mind.
All right, fair enough. I can respect that. Either way, though,
I would rather watch five first preseason games around the league, including teams that I don't care about and players that I'll never see, than watch a Burton movie. Let's just put it that
way. Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. It's probably a gender gap. I mean,
Chris,
sorry, a year gap, generation gap.
I was just about to say, wait a second. A gender
yeah,
gap.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
You're
I'm
either
sorry,
revealing
God.
Something about yourself or accusing something
no
about
comment.
Me.
And, no and comment.
I don't know which one it is.
No comment.
It better be the former, not the latter, I can tell you that.
No, generation gap.
Okay, and now you're calling me old. All right, very good. All right, well, you know what? Hold on. What were you, like six when that Batman came out, Batman Returns?
First one, I was 3. But I watched Batman Returns when I was like 10. So.
See, I was actually a teenager then. In fact, 1989 it came out. I was like 20 actually then. So I watched it first run, and I was a DC Comics junkie growing up, and I was a huge Batman fan, and I watched that, and I just wanted to punch it. I wanted to punch the screen because of what Burton did to my
He's favorite. Not for everyone. I think he really inspired a whole generation of like goth kids and everyone else. I kind of went to high school.
You're probably right. That's another reason to hate him, for inspiring goth. All right, hey, good stuff, Chris. Thanks, brother. Great work on the website. Thanks for the review and the preview actually of the game tonight, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Talk to you later, man.
Chris Lemieux doing Lions coverage like nobody else, thankfully. I'm just kidding. At PrideOfDetroit.com. We'll preview the Browns preseason game number one with Dennis Manilow at 4:35. We'll talk to you and take some phone calls next, right after SportsCenter on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
We're going to put a team out there that's going to go out there and play hard, execute our offense and defense and special teams, and that's what we're looking to do. I think everything's earned. You know, I'm not giving anybody anything. Whatever decision we make will be based on the feeling of how long we want guys to play. It won't be because of the weather, because we have to learn how to practice against each other, take care of each other, and do things the right way. You know, this is a little bit different phase of training camp because now we're about to play an opponent. I'm really eager to see our whole football team, you know, against a different opponent. But obviously, watch our quarterback, you know, under duress, you know, when it's tough, when the other team is really coming after you. But also our offensive line, our defensive line, and our secondary, you know, and our linebackers. I'm going to be very into watching our football team play, and I'm probably going to have to catch myself because I have so many responsibilities as we go through this. But I'm very excited about our guys going out and competing against somebody else for a change.
I can't tell you how valuable having an opportunity to work against a team, and a very good football team, obviously. Yeah, well, some guys you don't have to see as much of, you know, and if you want to see a lot of the younger guys, because you know some of your older guys got a lot of good work, we'll look at that and kind of temper the number of reps that they had, so you may not see some of the older guys much, if at all, in some cases. In other cases, you'll see some of the young guys a little bit more. You know, I think he's delivering the ball better on time. I think he's gotten a little bit better feel for the concepts that we're using. I can see him kind of working through his progressions a lot more quickly, you know, just to see how we go and make adjustments with different personnel groupings, with heavy personnel or whatever it might be. But then also execution is key. You know, we want to see guys get in there and play well, and they'll be able to do their job correctly.
Stolen by LeBron James, laying in the weeds. Get out of his way.
LeBron again.
You know, anytime I got anything new, exclusive, I'm bringing it to y'all first. So, and I'm re-signing back with the Cleveland Cavaliers, man. My hometown team, I can't be more excited.
And in transition, James! Oh, with the hammer! James keeps his dribble somehow. Irving back to James! Oh, he throws it down!
This opportunity once again, defend our crown, you know, defend our title. And we all know last year was a magical, inspiring, all the words you could come up with, man, it was an unbelievable season.
James fakes, James drives, James finishes, and the foul.
And I just can't wait to get the group back together, man. You know, the team, the franchise, you know, lastly, you know what I'm saying? Let's get JR done. It's that time.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is indeed a done deal, a 3-year extension for LeBron James, $100 million. Really nice montage put together there by Jim Cushlin, who, if I didn't mention, is not here today. Yeah, Cushlin isn't. The crowd goes wild. I don't know why that is, but that's the good news. The bad news is he's kind of here because he's monitoring and listening out at YARC. And Jim Cushlin, when he's monitoring and listening, you know he's going to call in to defend his honor. From YARC Chrysler, Jeep, Dodge, and Ram out on the Central Avenue Strip, Mr. Cushlin weighs in. What's up, Cush? How you feeling?
I'm feeling all right, but I see how it is. I'm not there in the crowd. Cheers. I see how it is, y'all.
I don't know why it is. You're going to have to figure it out from them. I don't know why, but any time I have ever announced that Jim Cushlin has the day off, people just go... They just seem to, I don't know, they enjoy themselves a little bit more.
Oh, brother.
I know my wife at the time told me I can be annoying. I didn't think I was that annoying.
Well, all I know, I never did either. You know, we bring we open up the doors and allow the live studio audience in here each and every day to join us, and we have a great time talking to them during the breaks, and they're really attentive when we're on the air, and it's really a great time. But anytime they walk in and sit down and I announce to them, hey, Ben Lahowski is running the show today, they cheer. And now when I say Jim Cushlin is not here today, they go crazy. Just like that, there they are, almost on cue. I asked them once, is it because you don't like Cushlin?
That's the fact, yeah!
Or if it's because you really like Lahowski. And those are kind of the results that we get here. I mean, it's just...
Well, it's good to know going forward where I really stand on the
That's just what it is. But Jim Cushlin did do a very nice job. Did he not, Ben Lahowski? A really nice job on that
montage.
Oh, yes,
absolutely.
All right, I guess that's not a winner either.
I had to get some of the everything in there. It's one of those fun Fridays for early August. I mean, it's sort of football, I guess, with being preseason, but you got that opening. Then you got the whole LeBron signing. I'm loving this particular deal. And don't forget baseball, assuming it's not pouring rain as the storms are coming through here. It could be in Cleveland for that game. I don't think for the Tigers, though. They're in Texas. So you got all that going. It's a pretty crazy Friday for early August.
Yeah, speaking of baseball, it's the reason I wanted to talk to you real quick and interrupt you is I hope you don't have a card that you got to sell. If you got to go write somebody up and drop the paperwork and run their credit, let me know, and you can go and
do
that.
I will do exactly that. If
out there at Yark, great deals, no doubt about it, out there from our friends at Yark. But let's talk about baseball from this standpoint. Rodriguez is about to play his last game in a Yankee uniform. It's tonight. If it isn't rained out there, too, they got rain in the area there, too. But he's about to play his last game with the Yankees. And it's funny because they noticed it. I didn't really pick up on it myself. But Greenberg and Golic did yesterday when they said, you know, if you listen to him carefully, the day they had the press conference, which was what, Sunday? It was on Sunday that they announced the plays.
Yeah, that was before their game Sunday, yep.
Yeah, he said, today, you know, I'm going to say goodbye to the Yankees and to baseball. And which means it's not just his Yankee career is over because they're releasing him, but he's, you know, retiring from the game. He never said anything about baseball again in all of the commentary or interviews or comments that he's made since then during the week. He just says to the Yankees, meaning it's entirely possible he's not saying goodbye to baseball, that he's done with the Yankees and he'll serve out his commitment as advisor and whatever else they're going to do, you know, whatever honorary title they gave him. But that he's going to be in camp with somebody next spring. And some, you know, maybe it's the Marlins, of course, who allowed Ichiro to come out there and contribute and chase 3,000 hits. Would they allow Alex Rodriguez to come out there and chase 700 home runs and try to contribute as they try to build a National League pennant winning championship team too? But there's probably very, very small, a very small market for them. But there's got to be a market for him, but there's got to be at least a team or two that would be interested in bringing a 41-year-old who just hit 33 home runs last year and suddenly just didn't have anything this year.
Yeah, and when I've heard those rumors in the last couple of days as well, and the Marlins would sound like one of the perfect candidates. You have Jeffrey Loria, who will do a publicity stunt if necessary, and as you mentioned, A-Rod, for what it's worth, is only four homers shy of 700. There is that. There's also a possibility that they may even attempt to do it, although I think this is a very, very low likely, for the remainder of this season. Somebody, I forget who it was that I was reading it from, they were punting. Certificating that, you know, the Marlins, they could use an extra a lefty bat in a platoon possible situation because there's not getting much out of one of their other bats off the bench, and then you factor in Loria. I still highly doubt it, especially for this season, but yeah, the Marlins would seem like a prime candidate if anybody is going to pick up that phone and inquire about Alex Rodriguez, obviously on a much, much reduced pay,
of course. Yeah, I mean, it would just be him trying to catch on at a veteran's minimum, I'm sure.
Sure. No, yeah, absolutely. No team is going to want to import anything close to what that contract has with the Yankees or what's left of it anyway. This would be a whatever the minimum in this kind of situation would be in baseball. That's what it would be. But, yeah, I would put the Marlins at my top of if anyone's going to inquire about A-Rod list. The Marlins are on the top of it for me.
Yeah. Now the other part of this, of course, is if this is it, and it may be. Maybe the Marlins don't do that. Maybe nobody does that. If this is it and tonight is the last game for Alex Rodriguez, the interesting question here isn't what is his legacy going to be, because his legacy is going to be one that is mixed. People are going to call him one of the greatest young prospects ever who had one of the greatest careers going ever. And we pointed that out yesterday on the program as we looked at his statistics in
right.
Seattle and talked about before he got to Texas and the monumental numbers that he put up before he ever was involved with steroids by his admission or by any of the evidence against him. And there's no doubt he was on track to being a Hall of Fame type player before that. But then he did cheat. And as I've said many times, once you cheat, it invalidates virtually everything you've ever done, including Barry Bonds, including Roger Clemens, guys who would have been Hall of Famers no matter what, had they not cheated. So, you know, and I've likened that to the test-taking thing. Just for those who have never heard the analogy, I love it. And I credit my friend Dennis Mandeloff for sharing this with me several years ago. If you're a student taking a test, no matter how important the test is, and it's 100 questions long, and you get the first 99 right, you're killing it. And then your last one, you're stumped. And you're not satisfied with 99 out of 100. You want 100 out of 100. And so you cheat on the last one. And you let your eyes wander over to somebody else's paper. And you steal the answer from them. What do you get on the test? Does the teacher give you, no, you can't do that. We can't have you cheating on that last question. That one's wrong. You get 99 out of 100. Or do you get a zero for cheating on the test? You get a great big fat F. When you cheat, you're disqualified. That's it. And that's how I see it with Alex Rodriguez. That's how I see it with Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, and all the other steroid cheats in the baseball steroid era. Now, having said all of that, the interesting question is, if steroids were never a thing, if we had never heard of them, whether we used them or not is irrelevant, but we just didn't know that they existed. We just have Alex Rodriguez's career numbers sitting where they are. Where would he rank as the greatest baseball players of all time? I heard Mike and Mike talking about that this morning, and I was fascinated. I thought I had heard all of the Alex Rodriguez discussions by this point. I just kind of figured I'd heard it all, and we'll just commemorate the end of the career today, the last game, blah, 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 and that's all we'll do today. But when they brought that up this morning, I thought, I'll be dang, that is another angle to this I have never really considered. Where is he if you take that out? You look at his career batting average is going to be .295. His career home runs is .696. His RBIs, 2,085, third most all time. 329 stolen bases. He could run. He was a gold glove at shortstop. You compare that type of offensive or that type of career, because I just threw in the shortstop part too, to that of Babe Ruth, to that of Willie Mays, to that of Mickey Mantle. By the way, those guys were all outfielders. They're supposed to be powerful guys. To that of who else do you want to throw into the mix here as greatest players of all time, individual players of all time? I think those are the names that come up the most. You know, more modern guys like Bonds and Ken Griffey Jr. Greeny said this morning that if you take away steroids, and like not that you take away production because it was helped by steroids, take away the thing that it never existed,
right,
and you
right.
just have this guy, you could make a case that he is the greatest baseball player who ever lived and defend that. You might not win the argument. Somebody might bring up Ruth. Somebody might bring up some of the other things. But as evidence, he pointed to the fact that his 400 and, what was it, 70-some-odd home runs in the decade of the aughts from 2000 through 2009 is the second most, or is it the most? Now I forgot which one it was. It was either, I think it might be the most. The most home runs in any individual decade in history. I think they said it passed Babe Ruth, who had 400 and some odd in the decade of the 1920s. You add all of those things up, you could make a case and defend it that Alex Rodriguez was the greatest individual baseball player in history if steroids were not a thing that anybody had ever heard of before. Would you agree?
Boy, and that's a great, great question, because you're right. You know, given that it's Alex Rodriguez we're talking about, we've never really contemplated this because we've never, you know, even thought of trying out this hypothetical, as you're pointing out. You know, take the concept.
See, ironically,
of steroids,
ironically,
yeah.
Enough, Jim, I that's not true for me. I had considered this prior to learning about the steroids. You know, because like I said to you yesterday, or maybe it was on Tuesday or Wednesday, I don't know. But the steroids, to me, hit me really hard because I was counting on Alex Rodriguez to reclaim for the good guys, for the non-cheats, the home run crown. You know, Hank Aaron was the home run king. And when Barry Bonds stole it from him illegally, it bothered me that a cheater was going to be rated at the top of that list over, you know, a clean guy.
Yeah.
And so at the time, several years ago, I thought the only guy who can stop this travesty from being at the top of the books for all time, you know, the record books, is Alex Rodriguez. A-Rod, even though, you know, he had the personality problem, he was a jerk and he was self-centered and all the stuff that people hate about him, he was a clean guy. And he's a guy who was pacing that if he could continue doing what he was doing, that he could possibly, you know, be the guy that breaks the record and takes it back on the side of, you know, good, if you will, in good versus evil, like we had Lily King versus the Russian swing.
Right, right.
And so I had considered he might be the greatest, not just home run hitter, but player of all time, if he stays on that pace. But once again, that was before hearing about steroids. Once steroids were discussed and suddenly we found out he was involved, that invalidated that concern or that, you know, that, that, that possibility.
Right, and it's a reason for, it's the reason that I'll at least say for me personally, Bob, I hadn't really even thought about it from this angle, but trying to think of this for a few minutes since you brought it up, and what a great question that, Mike and Mike throw out there to, have us all dabble in. I'd have to really consider some of the other players, but he'd certainly be in my top 7 to 10 all-time players overall, and the one thing I would be able to say with certainty, greatest shortstop ever, because you got the glove, and the bat. You know, usually those don't both happen with shortstops, right?
And over it's the course well, of history. That's one of the reasons they cited Jim. You know, the other guys who are considered to be the greatest players of all time are what? They're all outfielders.
Right. Ted Williams. Usually all outfielder, maybe a corner infielder, but never really middle infielders or catchers.
No, not even a corner infielder with the guys we're talking about.
Oh, really?
Okay. Well, I mean, you'd have to think about it. I mean, the only people who have ever been called potentially the greatest players of all time are Babe Ruth, Willie Mays, Ted Williams,
yep,
and maybe that's it. Maybe Mickey Mantle, but I think he even comes up short in the center fielder thing against Willie Mays. So they're all outfielders, which are supposed to be big time power producing positions,
especially in the corners.
Never has a shortstop been able to do these things. Shortstop is widely accepted to be what? The most important and difficult defensive position on the field.
Yep,
you know, maybe outside of the catcher, but even then. You know,
and to talk about the lack of a bat at that position,
right,
you know, that,
right.
That's what kept Mendoza of Mendoza line fame in the league for so long because liked his glove.
Because the glove,
they'll
right.
tolerate the 200 or 198 or whatever the heck he hit. But,
add all of those things up to for the outfielders, they're all playing on that playing field, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon the pun, but they're on that playing field, whereas Alex Rodriguez is on the infield and more or less, or moreover, on the middle infield, which you don't get this from. So when you add all of that production, which has eclipsed Mays and has eclipsed Mantle and eclipsed everybody except for Ruth and Bonds, you know, we're talking about a defensive position that you're not supposed to be able to play that well and be that good offensively that he played, you know, like I said, with gold glove efficiency before voluntarily going to third base when he signed with the Yankees and deferring to the captain, Derek Jeter. He was by far a better shortstop than Derek Jeter. By far. Far more range, made more spectacular plays. Jeter was a good, solid shortstop, but never the gold glover that that A-Rod was. Even when he won gold gloves, it was more respect than it was, you know, actual wizardry out there.
Right, because usually A-Rod or Omar Vizquel were taking the gold gloves from Jeter at that position at that time.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you add the offense and the defense and the defensive difficulty of the defensive position that A-Rod might be, and again, there's that question, you know, if steroids had not been invented or had not been discovered or discussed or what have you, all things being equal, he might be the best player of all time. So you would put him, you said, in your top 10. I mean, I got to tell you, I would go higher.
I'm even sitting here rethinking of it, especially when you really factor in the shortstop part of the equation.
Yeah.
So I'll go somewhere top five amongst the Ruth and the Mays and those kind of guys in the top five, and without question, the best shortstop of all time. Again, of course, as you mentioned, if we throw the concept of steroids out the door, then he's top five all time, somewhere in that mix. I'd have to really sit down for a few minutes and really think about it. Do I want to give him number one overall and take it away?
Because
Ruth is still my personal number one just because of how transcendent he was, even though this was almost 100 years ago now, how transcendent he was and how much he individually changed the entire concept of the game. Rodriguez didn't do that, so I might have to put him number two behind Ruth, but he would certainly be, without question, the greatest shortstop ever.
What made Ruth so much different there, when you talk about transcendent, and Mike pointed that out too, is that, you know, in the era he played in the 20s, there were teams that didn't have 50 home runs in a season.
That's just unfathomable when you think about it through today's prism.
It's like what Ruth did on an annual basis in the 20s is like what Michael Phelps is doing every 4 years on the Olympic
scale. There's a decent comparison that somewhat gets it in the ballpark.
Yeah, because he's got, you know, Michael Phelps now has what, 22?
We're up to 22 now, yes. He got another one last night.
And he's got two more possible golds to go here. But anyway,
I gotta believe you gotta give him minimum one to put him at 23 minimum.
He's got 22 gold medals that we know of right now, which again, as we pointed out, is more than 90 some countries have as entire nations, all events combined.
Yep.
All summer Olympic events combined, not just swimming medals, but swimming, track, wrestling, gymnastics, the whole nine yards. That's Ruth. You know, 50 home runs in a season when teams weren't hitting 50 home runs in a season. Yep. So to put it,
remember, he was
context,
so good with the bat at that time that they forcibly took him off the pitcher's mound.
Right.
He held for 35, 40 years until I think Whitey Ford in the early 60s held the longest consecutive scoreless streak for a pitcher in World Series play for like 40 years.
You're right, and we need to kind of put some of those things out there to give it context when we talk about the greatest players ever. We are slaves to the modern time. We don't have a whole lot of film of Babe Ruth. We have film even of guys like Jim Brown. We have film, limited, but film of Gale Sayers and others.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say, you know, where does Barry Sanders rank on the all-time list of greatest runners, we have 1,000, you know, miles and of footage of him running the ball.
Right.
We have some that we can compare, you know, those other guys from the 50s and 60s to, but not a ton, but we have some. With Babe, we got virtually nothing. You know, we just have to let the numbers speak for themselves. We don't. It's like we were talking about bad guys yesterday. Was that yesterday? We were talking about bad guys and Ray Rice and the whole thing.
Yes,
you know, the video makes all the difference.
Yep.
I think that's the thing. We forget about Babe Ruth because we don't, not that we forget about him, but those guys from that era and Lou Gehrig and others, we kind of forget about how great they were because they were so long ago and there's no video to remind us.
Yep.
We have to go back and look at the stats and let them paint a picture or run a movie in our heads for us of all of those shots and Babe Ruth on the mound pitching as great as he did, as you point out, and all those kinds of things. We have to let that stuff kind of, you know, marinate in their own numbers.
And this is where, and when you think about it from that context as well, the lack of video and stuff of some of these guys who were 80, 90, 100 plus years ago, because of course baseball goes back to the 1870s as far as the major leagues are concerned. Yeah, this is where all those wonderful baseball stats and numbers really come into play, more so than even in basketball or even in football, for example. This is where those come into play, and to a degree you have to let some speak for themselves. So yeah, as I keep thinking more and more about this, I throw out steroids, I'd be willing to put A-Rod number two behind Ruth all time and greatest shortstop if we throw out the steroids.
So you would, so now again, if we're saying we didn't hear about steroids,
right,
you're saying you would still put A-Rod number two over Bonds?
Yes.
Because Bonds steroids also,
different,
we have to eliminate them for him too.
Yep.
And look at,
yeah,
his
if totals. We eliminate it for him, here's my logic in that. The shortstop thing again. That's the shortstop thing. Bonds was always an outfielder. Shortstop's a different animal.
It was, agreed, but some would argue that Barry Bonds was the best left fielder, not just of his generation, but maybe ever, from that defensive standpoint. It might not be as hard to play as shortstop was, but he played it better than anybody else. He was an absolute miracle out there in the outfield, just like Ken Griffey Jr. was in center, just like Willie Mays was in center prior to that.
Right.
You know, the greatest, one of the greatest defensive players at his position ever. It would be very hard for me to put A-Rod over Bonds in that regard, and I can't stand Bonds.
Yeah.
I can't stand A-Rod either, but here we go.
Most people couldn't stand him, and that was before we knew about the steroids.
That's exactly right. But here we go. I mean, so if we, I don't know. I don't know if I can do one through five right now as far as the order, but I would
tell
you.
That's why it's tricky. That's why my first answer was saying he's definitely would be in the, A-Rod would be in that top five. And I just keep thinking of the shortstop thing more and more as this conversation goes on.
That is a difference maker. Yeah, you know, when you're talking about splitting hairs here, you're looking for one thing that could be, you know, a difference maker. And that position might be it. But to me, there's Babe and in the top five, Alex would be there if there weren't such a thing as steroids. Or at least we didn't know about them. But that would be there. He would be there, I should say. Bonds would be there. Mays would still be there.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Griffey might be there. In fact, probably would be there in Ted Williams. Or did I just name six? What did I do?
That was six. So we'd already have to decide between Griffey and Ted Williams.
Somebody's got to go, and I don't know who it is, and I don't know how to do it, like you said, because then you're getting into Mantle and Musial and some of those other guys, and Hank Aaron, of course, as well. Gehrig, it's very tough to do, and we haven't even named a pitcher yet.
You just took the words out of my mouth. We haven't even named a single pitcher yet.
Yeah, but he's still, I think, Alex Rodriguez, given the whole body of work, if none of this was tainted by steroids, would be in my top five all time. All right, let me get a time out here. It's 4:33. We're going to get a sports there. We're going to come back, and since it is the first day of NFL preseason action for the Browns and the Lions, we talked with Chris Lemieux of PrideOfDetroit.com about an hour ago. Now we're going to talk with Dennis Maniloff of Cleveland.com about the Browns and the Packers tonight and what we can expect to see there, especially from the new starting quarterback, RG3. How much time will he get against those Packers? So we'll talk with D-Man coming right up on The Ticket.
X5 The Ticket. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, and we roll along. It's 4:40. It's time to talk a little bit of NFL preseason action. Thanks to Chris Lemieux of PrideOfDetroit.com for talking Lions with us last hour. Now we turn our attention to the Cleveland Browns. Preseason football, first time under Hugh Jackson, first time with Robert Griffin III under center. And joining us now is Dennis Maniloff, the outstanding sports writer, long time for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Cleveland.com, and the Northeast Ohio Media Group. And also, of course, for himself, the author of an outstanding book called From A to Z, Andrew's Disastadilla, a collection of Plain Dealer sports writer Dennis Maniloff's favorite interviews. D-Man, what's going on, brother?
Hey, Bob, before we get into the meat, you know what my dream job is? I want to be the guy who does, this is Bob France on 106.5. I love that voiceover guy. He's everywhere.
We all want to be that guy, by the way. We all want to be that guy. I've talked about that myself, Dennis, I want to come back in another life as the big voice guy. All he's got to do is sit in his studio and then tell the world about the show that's coming up. The guy doing the show's got to do 3 hours of talking. All he's got to do is put on his best pipes and go, and now, Dennis Maniloff on ESPN, 106.5, The Ticket.
If you think you're special, you're not, because he does 150 of them around the country.
Exactly, and gets residuals every time it's played, for crying out. It's just a great gig to have. I would love to be big voice.
All right, let's hit it.
All right, D-Man. Robert Griffin III, now the newly proclaimed starter for the Cleveland Browns, the 25th, is it, on that jersey since 1999, on the long jersey?
Yeah, 25. He's got to start a game, though.
He's got to start a game in the regular season to be that guy. But, you know, he's been proclaimed 25. As such. So, first things first, before we talk about what we'll see out of him in preseason, and not very much, I'm sure, as is the standard, but what are your thoughts? I haven't asked you yet since he was named the starter. Are you good with Hugh Jackson mentoring, but trying to bring the best and reclaim the talent that Robert Griffin showed as a rookie in this league?
No question. I certainly would rather have Robert Griffin III on this roster than not. Okay, that's for starters. And you know, then you look at the potential upside, and you realize this guy only a few years ago. Granted, you know, it's ancient history in NFL years, but only a few years ago he was really, really good. And so there is a ceiling, potentially at least. Plus, he's still at an age where he can recover. And resuscitate his NFL career. He's not a 35-year-old beaten down guy who's trying to recover the magic one last time. So there is an upside that could be tapped. The odds are long, I grant you, but if anybody can get the most out of him, it's Hugh Jackson. And I like the Josh McCown as backup setup for a number of reasons. So I believe that the Browns with Griffin at one and McCown at two, and then the developmental Kessler, that's a good lineup for this team.
You know, when the Browns signed him, I thought to myself, what is Robert Griffin thinking? I know he wants to be a starter in this league again. I know his time in Washington was over. I get it. But why would you go to the place where quarterbacks go to die? And that's what Cleveland has been, as we know, since 1999. And my thought process was, he's going to come to a place that's losing two of their best offensive linemen, you know, two starting offensive linemen in Mack and Schwartz, and to a team that might have the worst core of receivers in the National Football League, and one of the worst cores over the course of the last maybe 10 years in this league. But now things look a little bit different, at least in the latter, for the latter, because the massive stockpile of receivers they took on draft day, coupled with the emergence of Terrell Pryor and the possible return, and we don't even know what he's going to look like yet because he's still got the quad problem, but the possible return, if he can keep himself clean of Josh Gordon, with Corey Coleman and some of the other guys, it's suddenly not a bad looking receiving core for Robert Griffin III, to work with.
Yeah, correct. I mean, first of all, I don't think there were that many suitors for Robert Griffin III. All right. I don't know exactly what the market was. I can't remember, but I think the Browns were on a very small number of teams list that was coveting Robert Griffin III or really wanted him. So he didn't have a ton to choose from. He certainly has a guy in Hugh Jackson who believes in him. Otherwise he wouldn't be here. Jackson has great credentials. Griffin has to know that, and I'm sure researched it. And in their meetings, too, they talked about the work that Jackson has done with other QBs in this league. So you're right, Bob. When you talk about the things that Griffin has going for him here, plus he's not going to a team that is expected to win 12 games in the regular season and go to the conference final, much less the Super Bowl. All right. We know where this team is. We know where the Cleveland Browns franchise is. It is in the early, early stages of a rebuild, all right? So I'm not saying that Griffin wants to go out there and lay eggs. Of course not. He wants to play well. He wants to, compete and win, of course. But the reality is if he doesn't deliver victories but he looks competent, he's going to have staying power here, all right? It's not like, oh my gosh, you know, Robert Griffin III, quote unquote, failed to get the Browns to the playoffs this year. There's no expectation of playoffs. So Griffin can try to resuscitate his career with less pressure, I believe, than he would if he had gone to some other team that was thinking playoffs.
I think that's very true, and he doesn't want that kind of pressure as he tries to figure out what made him great before. He has a rookie, the offensive rookie of the year, even over the likes of Andrew Luck, and of course what has been missing since he's been able to replicate that in the last two years or so. Of course, he had the injury that cost him a lot of time and a lot of mobility, but he's got his mobility back. I understand he's back into the 4.4 range in his 40. There is nothing slowing him down other than his own demons of the last 2 years and shaking that poor play that he's displayed and that has hurt his own confidence. So to that end, step one is tonight, right? What are we looking at? Traditional, typical one series or so for the starters, or does Hugh want to see more out of him given the fact that this is a new learning curve?
No, it's probably going to be very vanilla and very brief. I don't expect much, and we haven't heard that there would be any more than a minimal amount. That's fine. You know, those guys know. You know, Jackson knows, the coaching staff knows, Griffin knows, so I'm not concerned at all about what I see or don't see in the preseason other than stay healthy. And of course, Bob, if there was utter incompetence when Griffin was in the game, then you'd be like, oh, okay, what the heck's going on? But that's not going to happen. I mean, he's not going to be completely confused, and he's not going to be throwing balls into the ground during the preseason. So, short of that, there's really nothing in the preseason that's going to move my needle. It's all going to be, okay, building up to the regular season, and how are you going to play? How are you going to look under center when it counts?
Dennis, what is going to move the needle for you tonight in preseason game number one? We know that the score doesn't matter. We know that the starters aren't going to see very much time for all of the reasons you just outlined, not just with Robert Griffin, but just across the board because of the way that it is. But we also know this is a team looking to stock the roster with talented guys. They got a lot of competition at a lot of positions. You can either pick a person or a series of guys that you say you're really looking at seeing, or you can choose to say just a position. I need to see where the pass rush is coming with Brian out. I need to know where and how we're getting to other teams' cornerbacks. I need to find out who who are our cornerbacks going to be, if Joe Hayden is banged up and that sort of thing. So where's your attention going to be focused for the most part tonight?
Yeah, the sarcastic answer for me, Bob, is that, this game means that we're one day closer to the regular season because the preseason doesn't mean a whole lot, but I get your point. Mm-hmm. And for a rebuilding team, you want to keep an eye on a lot of young guys.
Sure.
Because that's what this roster's full of. On the offensive side, Terrell Pryor's a fascinating case. I'm assuming he's going to play tonight. I haven't checked the latest updates. I think he was dealing with a calf injury or calf tightness or something to that effect, but indications are he's going to play. Pryor's a fascinating guy to look at, you know, making the position change. Coaching staff really likes him. He seems genuinely, you know, devoted to his craft. He has bought in entirely. So I want to see what progress he makes when the you know, when guys are hitting him and when he's trying to catch the ball in traffic, things like that. Other, I guess, on the offensive side that I'm thinking about, non-Griffin, probably the right side of that offensive line. You know, how are they going to hold up? Who's going to be the right tackle for the Browns? But on defense, I'm looking at a guy like Barkevious Mingo. I'm assuming, again, that he's going to play. Mingo's a guy, he was obviously a first round pick for them a few years ago, but I would imagine he's on a short leash, with this regime. And, you know, it's put up or shut up time for Barkevious Mingo. I suppose if anybody can get the best out of him, it would be Ray Horton. So we'll see, but.
Let me go back, if I may, to the offensive line. You mentioned the right side of it. I'm looking right at the center of it. Cameron Irving is expected to be the guy to replace Alex Mack, and he's got a lot of proving to do. He's a first-round pick that proved to not be first-round pick quality in his rookie year, and I still can't get the picture out of my head of him just getting literally run over and knocked flat on his back in the middle of the backfield by himself. And he just did not acquit himself well in his rookie season. Some guys are late starters, late bloomers. Maybe that's the case. But he's got to not only improve in that regard, but also switch positions from guard to center. That's going to be a big one for me, too. But then again, he probably won't get much time tonight any more than the other three first-string guys would be.
Yeah, it's a great call by you, Bob. I had forgotten the very middle of the offensive line, but you're right. Cam Irving is absolutely critical. You know, you lose Alex Mack, you replace him with a guy who, by his own admission, had a rough go of it last year. I've listened to and read what has been said by the Florida State coaches, and they said that he's best suited for center, that he'll be okay, and of course they're going to say that, I guess, but the cynic would say, but, you know, we'll see how that goes. He's one of those guys where I wish he would play a little more, because you want to see meaningful reps from a guy who's making it such a difficult transition. But he is going to be very important. His ability to play center is going to be very important for not only the Cleveland Browns, but specifically for Robert Griffin III.
3 weeks ago, Dennis, we're talking to Dennis Mantloff, a little NFL preview action tonight. First preseason game for the Browns is against the Packers. We talked about the Steelers and the Lions tonight, earlier in this hour tonight as well. But Dennis, 3 weeks ago, Isaiah Crowell was arguably in a very dangerous position for as far as his roster spot. He had brought so much embarrassment and shame to the franchise with that unbelievably irresponsible Instagram picture that he posted with the officer. Now, in the last 3 weeks, I have heard nothing but predictions that Isaiah Crowell is going to have a monster year. Our mutual friend Scott Petrak told me he could see this guy rushing for 1,200 yards this year. But he's going to be the feature back, and Duke Johnson is not going to be the feature back, but that Isaiah Crowell looks tremendous in camp thus far, and that this is the guy. You're chuckling. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not laughing. I mean, I'm not laughing at Scotty P. He's an incredible mind, and we love him, and he's a great football guy. I just think 1,200 yards from any Cleveland Brown is asking a lot, except maybe the quarterback position. But you know, to try to account for 1,200 yards. But I will say this: the Crow has done a remarkable job of recovering his reputation, or his whatever you want to call it. Because look, I think I went on your air and said I advocated they cut him because it was such an egregious thing that he did, and
so did I. So did I. I'm with you.
But yeah, I mean, even though I felt like he needed to attack it right then and there, come in and face the media before training camp started, because I thought it would be an unnecessary distraction once camp started. It turned out to not be, because when he got there, he addressed it, he spoke with the reporters, he dealt with it, and he was very contrite again, and he said he was very sorry and very upset with himself. So he handled it on balance as well as you possibly could, and he certainly is looking as though he's completely dedicated to his craft. And I'm not saying he's changing his attitude this year and he's like running with an anger because he's so mad at himself and he wants to prove to everybody that he's not a bad guy. That's not what we're talking about, but we are talking, I think, his focus was sharpened that much more because he, you know, he inflicted adversity upon himself. He probably realized how close he was to being out on the NFL streets. So he said, you know what? The Browns are giving me a chance here. I'm going to maximize it. And he's gotten nothing but high marks from those around him by all accounts.
Yeah, he really has. And you know, whether he's saying the things that he is saying to show his remorse and his regret for the purpose of saving that career, as you point out, how close he was to the street, or whether it is sincere, I guess nobody really knows. But what I do know is that he is going to try to play with a purpose, with a mission, like kind of like what you're saying, Dennis, so that there would never be a question. In other words, if anybody who is a Pro Bowler, you know, an established star in this league, steps in it the way he stepped in it to the point where we were calling for him to be cut, a Pro Bowler, a star player, wouldn't be called to be cut. He would probably have been more defended under his right to his own opinion and his own free speech. But when you're a nobody in the league, and that's not to be disrespectful, but it is what it is on the grand scheme of things. When you're a nobody in the league, which Isaiah Crowell pretty much is, and you do something like that, you can be on the verge of being out on the street. And I think he's playing to make sure that nobody ever thinks of him that way again in the event that there's some sort of mishap, lapse in judgment, or just outright stupidity that puts him into the world of controversy again.
You're right, Bobby. Of course you never want bad things to happen. You never want incidents or any of that. But if it's going to happen, what you pray for is something good comes out of it, all right? If it's going to happen, make something good come out of it or salvage something. And that is apparently what we're dealing with here. Crowell did something horrible, and he's trying to make right by it, all right? And that's a good thing, and it's helping him as a person. It's also helping the Cleveland Browns as a team because they have a guy on their roster who's motivated and who showed flashes, last year that he could play. So, you know, they might just get something productive out of Crowell. And if Scottie P saying 1,200 yards, then that much better.
He's not the only one. I've heard other people predicting big things from this guy. And again, that he's driven maybe like nobody has been in a while. Dennis Manilop, always great to get your thoughts on Browns and more. We appreciate it. I know you're watching the Indians very closely as well. We'll probably talk with you at some point next week and get an update on the state of the AL Central. Sound good?
Thank you, my friends.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate it. Music is a play, and that means Mike Miller is awaiting. Let's turn it over to Drive Time. Thanks so much for being a part of the show. We'll see you Monday.